said, "To Geraint, hope you enjoy reading the book and you can be very, very proud of what your son has achieved on and off the pitch, Ronan Na Gaire." And I thought, well, fair play to him. I knew then that actually I had, I suppose, contributed to saving this young kid's life. It was the worst throw-in, bless him, I've ever seen. You could see people also going, "Oh, shit, you better not laugh because that's a bad one." And I just said, he just looked at me and he could see his face was red. And I just said, "You know, I'm straighter than that." Everybody was laughing at what I said. He laughed and we moved on.
Hello and welcome along to another edition of the From the Horse's Mouth podcast. Once again, I am about to shut my mouth and hand over to two of the greats, Paddy Power and Ruby Walsh, in conversation with one of the real greats, Mr. Nigel Owens.
Thank you very much, Tom. Well, I was about to say it's not often we're in the presence of a world record holder. Before I say that, Ruby, do you have any world records?
No.
Not even through riding horses?
Definitely not, Paddy. Unfortunately, I rode around the same time as AP McKay. He has all the records, so I just followed along in his slipstream.
Geez, that's actually pretty disappointing. But anyway, it's not often we're in the presence of a world record holder on the podcast, but that's exactly what Nigel Owens is after taking charge of 100 test matches. Nigel, how are you? Thanks a million for joining us. And how's the retirement?
I've got a small holding and a 42 herd of Hereford, pedigree Hereford cattle at the moment. So I'm actually working more now than I've ever done when I was refereeing. So I'm still refereeing till the end of the season in the Pro 14 and locally, but obviously there are no local games at the moment. So sort of a semi-retirement from the international scene. So I had an ambition when I was 8 years of age that I wanted to be a farmer. It took me 41 years to achieve that. But so, you know, if you've got a goal, hang on to it because it certainly is achievable. To answer your question, Ari, it's going well so far anyway.
So that 100 test match is coming up and obviously retirement is in your head and you're kind of thinking, I'm going to need the local community a bit more. Was that why you arranged for them all to get free membership with Amazon so you'd be popular in the local community again?
Yeah. And that 100 game was, I forgot to answer your question there. Paddy, the 100th game was, I came out to the World Cup in 2019, which was going to be my last World Cup. And my aim in that World Cup was to do a semi-final because I'd done a quarter in 2011 and I did a quarter and final in 2015. So I wanted to do a semi-final at least. So I did a semi-final in 2019, which actually turned out to be the best game of the tournament, which was England against New Zealand. And I was on 97 test matches. And then I was given England, France, then in the Six Nations. And I, after the World Cup, and it was suggested to me then by the powers to be, people in charge of refereeing at the time, that, you know, we should finish now because we need to appoint the next generations of referees. And I said, you're asking me to do a very difficult thing. You're asking me to finish when I'm still one of your top referees. You know, I've just refereed the best game in the World Cup. So you're asking me to finish and I can't finish now. I don't want to finish now. And I said, I'm also on, you know, not that numbers is a goal for me, but I'm in the, after the Six Nations, I'd be on 98. You know, I'm just two games away from 100. And then they thought, all right, okay, we'll have a think about that. And then obviously COVID happened. A couple of people did not want to appoint me, which was very disappointing to get to 100 games. And I thought, well, that's very disappointing to hear from one or two of the selectors because, one, I was still reffing at the top of my game. And also as well, you know, the first referee to get to 100. It's not a case of, well, we're appointing you to games, but you're not reffing good enough, but we'll give you these two games. Because if that was the case, I'd have said, no, I don't want to do it. So I was a bit disappointed by that. But then thankfully, a couple of other selectors said, look, no, you know, he's still one of our top referees. All is given to the game over the years. You know, the least we can give him is to give him another two games to get to 100. And we're appointing somebody who's still one of our top referees. So anyway, I got to the 100. And then, yeah, it was, So at that 98th game was, I thought, right, yeah, you know, I would like to get to 100. But until then, when I was doing 89 games or 90 games, I wasn't thinking I'm going to keep on going till I'm 100. No, I wasn't. And then, you know, Ruby, as you said, the problem is some of the people in Manicetti don't even have Wi-Fi, so they didn't all have Amazon Prime, but a lot of them did. My father, bless him, my father can't use a mobile phone. My father's 85 years of age. And then he was phoning you, oh, wonderful, we got this thing so we can watch the game for free now when everybody in the village is, coming up. And, and he was getting free pints in the club on my back because they were getting free Amazon Prime. And then he realized that he couldn't get Amazon Prime because he hasn't got Wi-Fi. So he had to go with the club to watch it. So to be fair, they put Amazon Prime in the club as well. So it was, and I had a couple of very nice messages from people in the village and in Manicurig. And it was a very, very nice thing for Amazon to do, in all fairness. And they presented me with the gold whistle and everything as well. So, that was very, very, very much appreciated. So my popularity in Manicurig is okay for a couple of years, I think, really.
Very important in a wet time of year like this, and you with a full farm of cattle, you never know when you might need people. But just listening there as well, Nigel, I had to go to Willie Mullins to tell him I was retiring. I'd obviously told my parents, but it came the other way to you. I can understand how that was disappointing. And I didn't realise it was a whole team of selectors.
Yeah, there's a referee.
I thought it was one company.
There's
one
a referee
body.
Manager, which was Alan Roland at the time. He's since retired a few months ago from Ireland. So he was the sort of referee manager. And then he had two selectors with him, which would have been Lyndon Bray from the Southern Hemisphere and Joel Jute, who is now the referee manager from European Rugby. And then he would have had a coach, which was Nick Mallett, who was contributing from the coaching side of things about appointments. And then Anthony Buchanan, then the ex-Welsh international, who was a representative of the WIU on World Rugby. He was the chairman of the... So those were the group of selector process. And then obviously when Alan finished, then Paddy O'Brien then took over temporarily until Joel Jute was appointed. So it was a bit of both, to be honest. You know, I chose my ending. I decided, right, 100th game and out. And I wasn't going to give anybody the opportunity, if that was going to happen, to tell you, you're dropped, you're gone. So it was a bit of both. I did understand as well that, if I wasn't going to be about in 2023 for the World Cup in France, that they needed to bring other referees up to speed, ready for that, because World Cups and knockout games of World Cup are massive pressure games, different to many other games, because, it's not like if you referee in the Six Nations and you don't referee well, then you may only have one game in the Six Nations, then you're not refereeing international again then till the next window, which is about 3 or 4 months later. But if you don't referee well or, have a disastrous game in the World Cup, then you've got another game maybe in 5 days' time, or they can't really appoint you then to another game in the World Cup in the knockout games if you haven't refereed or something's gone wrong in the game before. So, they have a lot of work to do, because at the moment, if they, there's only one or two or three maybe referees at the moment who are refereeing well enough to be selected for knockout games in the World Cup. And it's only, coming up now to 2.5, 3 years away from the next World Cup. So I also understand, once I knew I was going to get that 100, I knew then, well, I'm either going to finish on the 100 or maybe I'd finish in the Six Nations and finish naturally the end of this season on the international stage as well. So that I was going to do anyway, and that was my choice. But to hear that one or two people didn't sort of want to appoint me to those two games to get the 100 was, I thought that was a bit disappointed and a bit hurt by that, to be honest, in one sense. But thankfully there were people there who were sensible enough. And as I said, if I wasn't reffing well enough, then I would have made the decision for them. And I said, look, no, don't appoint me to the next two games because I'm not enjoying it. I'm not refereeing well enough. But I was still enjoying it and still on top of my game. So it was my decision to finish on the 100 in discussion with World Rugby, obviously, about moving forward as well. So that would have contributed to it as well. But no, I was ready to go now. It was just the timing of, when the season I was going to go, So I did make the decision myself, but thankfully, there were enough sensible people there with enough respect for me, I would like to think, to point me to those two games. Because I thought I would have been pretty hurt by that if that had been the case.
Not to go too deep into it, but in terms of performing well as a ref, like, you know, is that keeping the game flowing? Is it not making a mistake? Is it because now there's like the TMOs in your ear the whole time, so you can go back and have a look at that pass or that tackle and all that kind of thing. And I get the importance of that for player safety and everything, but so there's some part of me, as maybe because I'm getting to that age, feels like the game loses a little bit of the fluidity or something like that, because there's always been little mistakes that the ref misses, and that's part of the nuance of it. And I mean, as I always felt playing and watching, the greatest refs are the ones that don't use the whistle that often, you know what I mean? And was that kind of how you would have approached it as well?
Yeah, it would be. It's a very, very difficult balance to get. Sometimes, you know, even in the latter part of my career, I sometimes got it wrong, where I would certainly not blow too much, but not blow enough. And sometimes you need to get a balance right of knowing when to blow the whistle and knowing where not to. And the easy part of refereeing was blowing the whistle. That's the easy part. The difficult part was knowing where not to blow it. And if you can get that balance right, because the laws are there for the reason, and by applying the laws and also the balance of empathy of not when blowing it, that's when the game will flow. If you go too much one way or the other, then the game will suffer. And sometimes in some games, I should have probably been a little bit quicker on a whistle a couple of times, which maybe contributed and helped the game, rather than being a bit too lenient on the whistle. But I'd like to think for most of the time, I got the balance right. So you are right in what you're saying. You know, if you can get that balance right, knowing where not to blow the whistle, then that certainly helps the game. And I think that's what sets apart then the best referees to the other referees. And the referees who get to the top and stay at the top of the game until they finish or age catches up with them, rather than just get there a couple of games and then they're on the way back down. And that's the one worry I have today, is there's so much pressure on referees today not to make mistakes. I look at some referees sometimes and it seems that they're scared on that field of making a mistake. Whether it's the pressure they put on themselves, whether it's this pressure that's put on them by the referees, managers, or the selectors, which is the case sometimes. And I think that then takes away the enjoyment on the field and their contribution to the game. And I watch some games sometimes, and I do worry a bit that there are some referees out there now who don't have that empathy. It's just, if this happens, this is what I got to do. And refereeing is not black and white. There's a lot of gray. And if you can navigate your way through that grey, you will contribute to a great game of rugby. It is a very difficult balance to get, as I said. And there's not many referees out there at the moment who can get that balance.
When you look at the TMO there, Nigel, and the help it was to rugby, and even me as a rugby fan, I think it has most definitely added to it. And then you look at the controversy surrounding VAR. Is rugby just so much more suited to a TMO than soccer is? Or did the soccer guys even ask the rugby lads how to use it?
I think rugby is suited more to TMO than football is. Or TMO is suited more to rugby than it is to football with the VAR. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think in the professional game today, it's impossible for you to get every single decision correct, particularly the grounding of the ball at his left, his hand, at his foot just touched the touchline. So it's impossible for you to humanly see that. So we need to understand and remember that technology is vital to get the correct decisions and the correct outcomes for the games. So it has its part in the game. But I also think that technology is being used too much. There's too many referees now relying on technology rather than just using technology to back a decision up when they humanly couldn't see it because of whatever reason. So it's gone too much the other way now. And the reason why I think it works better in rugby is because in rugby you have natural stoppages. So sometimes you stop for a scrum. Rugby tends to have more injuries because of the physicality and the impact in the game than football has. Not that I'm saying it has any more serious injuries, but it tends to have more injuries in the game. More stoppages, more substitutions coming on and off. So there's natural stoppages in the game. So when the game stops, the TMO can input something or they can look at something, and it doesn't take away from the game as long as it's not used too much. Now, sometimes it gets used too much and it takes away from the game. Football, relies a lot on the fluidity of the game. So if you think of a football game, sometimes it's 0-0, 1-0, 1-1. There's not much to jump up and down in football when a try or goal is being scored. In rugby, when a try or goal, kick at goal, penalties, points, there's a lot more points to score. And when a try is scored, you then have a natural stoppage of 90 seconds if they want to before they kick the conversion. So in that 90 seconds, you can check something with the team, or yes, it's fine, no, we need to disallow this. So it doesn't stop the fluidity of the game. Football, when the VAR comes in and stops the flow of the game, it takes away then from the simplicity and the fluidity of the game, which obviously then agitates a lot of football soccer supporters. Also, then the other key thing, I believe, is the communication. In rugby, you will hear what the referee says. You will hear what the TMO says. You will actually see the decision that they are debating or ruling on. So then that then helps everybody understand, right, okay, I may not agree with it, but I can understand why he's given him a red card or a yellow card, or why they disallowed the try, or why they penalized him. In football, a goal is scored, then they go to the VAR, and the next thing, the game is disallowed. Then everybody in the stadium and all the players on the pitch, they don't understand why the game is disallowed, because there's no explanation from it, because there's no communication with the referee, and there's no footage to show to the people in the stadium why it's disallowed. So then automatically then they are against the VAR. Whereas if you're watching at home, you can see it again and say, all right, okay, I can see now why that's disallowed. So those are the couple of reasons, I think, which makes the TMO process work a little bit better and naturally in rugby. But I do think that it is being used far too much in rugby. And football needs to be careful that they get that balance right as well, of using it, you know, only when it's really, really needed, and not using it too much or relying on it.
Here at Paddy Power, we want our gambling to be fun and encourage our customers to bet responsibly. That's why we offer a number of tools to help you stay in control, including the ability to set deposit limits, get reminders after a certain amount of time playing, and to take breaks. For more information, visit responsiblegaming.paddypower.com. 18+, begambleaware.org.
The Six Nations is starting up pretty soon, so hopefully. And will you be able to watch that as a fan, or will you start analysing the ref while you're watching it?
I'm probably going to have to do the both, to be honest with you, because I'm going to be working with S4C on the Welsh Six Nations game and doing some punditry and some pitch side analysis, probably more so, not just on the game, but also on the refereeing decisions as well. And not, I know what it's like when you get things wrong, or when you don't perform well, or you make a mistake, you know, and everybody's having a go at you. So I'm certainly not going to be one of these who's going to go out there and have a go at referees if they make a mistake. But what I hopefully will do is help people understand why a referee has given a correct decision, even though everybody may think he's wrong. But also as well, if a referee does get something wrong, it won't be a case where he's got that wrong. That is the wrong decision, because actually that ball has been knocked on. But this is probably the reason why the referee hasn't seen that. You can't defend the indefendable. I can't go out there and defend the referee when he's clearly got something wrong. But hopefully I will add a little bit where people understand, okay, yeah, that was a wrong decision, but we can understand why you arrived at the wrong decision. So, you know, that's what I hope I will bring to the punditry on SOC, and bring a different dimension to it. Because sometimes you watch a game at home now, and the commentators or the people in the studio and the pundits will say, oh, that's a great decision by the referee. And you're thinking, it's not. The referee's got that wrong. Or they say, well, the referee's got that wrong. You know, that should be a try. And no, it shouldn't be a try. The referee is right. So hopefully I will, you know, bring a little bit more from that aspect to it. So I will be watching the game. I'll have to be a little bit when I was refereeing, you know. You just referee what's in front of you. I'll just have to watch the game and sort of try not to jump up and down when Wales scored a try if Wales beat Ireland in the first game of the Six Nations.
It's highly unlikely.
If was the big word there, Paddy. But when you're sitting there, Nigel, and first referee comes, first big decision, goes for his pocket, and he doesn't have his cards, what will you say then?
That's the first time in 34 years that that has happened. I think in my mind, I was
safety net, Nigel.
Yeah, I think that was I was thinking about my retirement before it actually came. I think, and I left the cards in my changing rooms. Well, and again, you see, but an actual sort of something interesting is. Some people actually think, well, if the referee hasn't got the red or yellow card to show, that he can't send the person off. Well, you can. You know, if you haven't got your yellow card, you can still, and as I did, become yellow card or not, you're gone for 10 minutes. So, you know, hopefully then in that situation, I will be saying, well, look, yeah, he's probably done the same as me. You know, he's left his card somewhere, but he can still quite rightly send the player off, even though if he's got his cards or not. So, yeah, that was... To be honest with you, Ruby, I had a lot of messages from people afterwards saying that was a highlight of the game. It was such an awful game of rugby.
Yeah, Scarlets and the Dragons. It wasn't exactly exciting, was it?
It was a poor game of rugby. It was a poor game of rugby.
Do you enjoy the celebrity side of, like, in inverted commas? I mean, you are the most famous ref ever, and that with itself brings, I guess, opportunity and this kind of thing. Where you're, I mean, you're obviously clearly a man who likes to chat, but do you enjoy that?
Yes, I do enjoy it. Yes, I do. And if I was said to you, I don't enjoy, you know, doing stuff like this and chatting to people and doing the TV work and stuff I do, then I would be, you know, or telling you, well, no, I don't think I'm a celebrity. Then I wouldn't be honest with you because, no, I don't think I'm a celebrity. But you know, common sense will tell you when you're doing a lot of stuff like this that you are a well-known. Whether celebrity is the word or what category celebrity is a total different thing. So, you know, I'm not going to be dishonest and say, well, no, I don't enjoy it, or I don't think I'm a celebrity. I suppose, you know, if you're well known, then I suppose you are a type of celebrity. But I'm certainly not a massive celebrity. But I am well known, I suppose, and I understand that. And I do enjoy it. But this to me is the important thing, Paddy. Is I enjoy it because it comes natural to me. You know, I was on stage at 13 years of age doing stand up comedy. I was doing a 12-episode series on S4C as a young kid actor at 14 years of age. You know, I was doing presenting programs on S4C at 20 years of age. So it's what I do, really. So I haven't wanted to become a celebrity. I've just done what comes natural to me, what I've enjoyed, and then everything else has come with it, you know. And I didn't referee because I wanted to be famous or well-known. I have never gone out on that field to say quips because I want people to find me funny. I've said them because it just naturally comes to me. This is who I am. And obviously then the personal side of my life, the stories of, you know, of how I dealt with, you know, mental health stuff and bulimia and accepting my sexuality and talking about the suicide attempt. So all of that then has actually... So I suppose the first man to come out in professional rugby, because then Gareth Thomas came out, you know, two or three years after me. All that, I suppose, has added a different dimension to it. And then I've been talking on podcasts and stuff about that side of things, which would have never happened if I wasn't who I was. So, yeah, I do enjoy doing this stuff, but this is who I am. But I certainly don't do it because I want to be famous or I want to be known as a celebrity. Certainly not. It's just who I am. And this is what I do. And I get the buzz of speaking in front of an audience, you know, and people laughing when you talk about some of the anecdotes and the stories of refereeing, you know, and I enjoy that. And but I'm quite as happy as well not doing it, you know, when I'm on the farm here and, you know, and working hard and, you know, and I'm away from all the television cameras and all everything else. I love that as well. So I would quite comfortably be doing that for the rest of my life. So yeah, you know, to answer your question, I do enjoy it, but I'd like to think that I enjoy it for the right reason, you know, not sort of saying or doing things because I want to be famous. It's just sort of what's happened over the years, I guess. And also as well, you know, a bit like Ruby here is when you are the best for the period of time, or you are good at what you do, or you win things, and at that time you know, you are the best and whatever you do, and obviously you are going to become well-known, you know, because you're good at what you do. And so you're not doing that because you want to be well-known or want to be famous. You become famous or well-known because you're actually good at what you're doing. And that to me is something very different. But then I think as well, when you some of these reality shows now, and this is what I think people need to be really, really careful. Some of the reality shows now is people go on there, not because they're good at what they want to do, but they want to go on there for fame and fortune. And if you hear some of the very, very sad stories, how many people have taken their own lives after that fame has then weaned off or has, you know, gone in 18 months. Quite a few people from these reality shows have taken their own life. And to me, there's an important message here. You know, if you become famous, you become famous for the right reason. Don't want to be famous for the wrong reason. And I think that is very, very important. And I think that's something that a lot of people need to bear in mind when it comes to reality shows, which are fine. A lot of people like them, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, because I'm a massive fan of Mrs. Brown Boys. A lot of people don't like Mrs. Brown Boys and they say, that's rubbish, shouldn't be on telly. Well, hang on now, millions and millions of people like it. So of course it should be on telly. I love it. But I think there is an onus on these people then for the mental health side to make sure that these people are aware of what's going to happen, how they deal with it. And I think that is a very, very different fine line, I think, which I think is very important for people to bear in mind. I think when you want to be famous, then, you know, it has to be for the right reason, I think, not the wrong reason.
It's interesting you brought that up because I was actually about to ask you, because part of the brand Nigel Owens now is kind of, I guess, in inverted commas, your work on helping with mental health. And that's because of your decision to come out with your sexuality and talk about your own past, your own story. But does that become a burden then and a responsibility that you didn't necessarily ask for? I know you've accepted it and you're, as you just articulated there, probably openly, but is that something that's always there now? Because that's part of what you have to represent or something.
It is. I think it's also to remember that I don't have to do it. But I think it's important that I do it, because when I was in that very, very, very dark place alone, no one to turn to, knowing nobody else who would have the same experience as me, and it cost me within 20 minutes of my life. You know, I did something one night that I would regret for the rest of my life, when I left a note from my mum and dad and said that I couldn't carry on living my life anymore. And that was a very, very dark time. And you know, if the people hadn't, police helicopter was out searching for me, and you know, I was airlifted to hospital, a couple of days in intensive care, and then another week or so in hospital. And if I hadn't been found then, the doctor said to me, you know, in another 20 minutes, Nigel, it would have been too late to save your life. So I was very, very fortunate. And then what happened was then, quite a few years after that, the Lolliver, who were now publishing my second autobiography, which will come out now by Christmas next year, hopefully, because I finished, or I'm finishing the end of the season. They came to me back in 2006, I think, or 7. Sorry, it was 2008. They came to me in 2008 and said, look, we'd like to do a Welsh autobiography on you. And I said, well, no, you know, I haven't really achieved anything. I'd only just been appointed to, and I hadn't actually refereed the game by that time. I'd just been appointed to referee my first European Cup final, which was Munster against Toulouse in the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff. And I did my first Six Nations game, and I'd been selected to go to the World Cup in 2007. So I hadn't achieved anything really of significance in the rugby world. And they said to me, I said, well, no, look, I don't. And also as well, if I'm going to do an autobiography, it has to be an honest account of my life. You know, I'd just come out by then. It had been in the news reports when I came out about the suicide attempt. I'm going to have to be honest, and I don't really want to put this in a book for everybody to know my personal life, although some, you know, a lot of people did know. And then after I did come out, and it was in the press that I'd come out, I had a letter from a parent, from a mum. She was living down just south of Exeter, and she wrote me this handwritten letter, which I've kept. And she said in this letter, "I'd like to thank you for saving my son's life, because our son attempted at 16 years of age to commit suicide. We didn't know why. He got a second chance. We managed to find him in time. And we were living in fear every day that he was going to do it again. He wouldn't talk to us. He wouldn't tell why. And then one evening we had some friends round for dinner with their kids who were the same age as our kids. And in the conversation around the table was myself and Wayne Barnes had just been selected to go to the World Cup in 2007. And we were a bit of the new kids on the block. You know, we were selected in 2007 World Cup with 2011 in mind, which is pretty much what they are doing now, which I can understand why then they need to appoint new referees, which I totally agree with and understand. But it was a bit of a shock because a few older referees who had missed out now. And then the conversation on the table was by the parent of this kid was, I've seen they've, because they were big rugby people, I've seen they've appointed the World Cup referees. A bit of a shock. Wayne Barnes and Nigel Owens go in. And the father of this kid then, of all this kid's mates, said, isn't Nigel Owens, isn't he the gay referee? And the father of this kid said, yeah, he is. He said, he came out as gay just recently, but no, that doesn't matter. The most important thing is that he's a good referee. The kid heard this conversation. He then went upstairs and he Googled my name and read my story in one of the extras from the newspaper. And the following morning, he went down and said to his mum, he said, the reason why I take, and I get quite emotional when I think about this, he said, the reason why I try to take my own life as well, it was because the same reason as Nigel Owens did it. And his mum and dad said to him, and he knew now that his mum and dad would be okay with it because they'd heard the conversation the previous night. And they said, well, why didn't you tell us? Because it doesn't matter to us. You're our son. Exactly the same words as my mum said to me. You know, Joe, you're my son. I will love you no matter what. And I get quite emotional when I speak about this. So I knew then that actually I had, supposed, contributed to saving this young kid's life. And then the publishers came back to me and said, look, you know, we really think this book will be really interesting. It'll help a lot of people. And I said, you know what? I think it actually will. So that's why I agreed to do the autobiography. And then obviously it became more known. And then I've spoken about it on podcasts. I've spoken about it. I did a talk yesterday to a company in Ireland. I'm doing it to a company next week and end of the month in Ireland as well, around the mental health and dealing with adversity and breaking down barriers and how important it is to accept people who are different to what the norm is perceived to be. So I do know that it does help people. And it's not easy to talk about it. I still get very emotional thinking back about that dark time of what I put my mum and dad through. And but knowing it does help people and has saved lives, and I've had quite a few messages after that, it does. I do feel then that it's important. I don't have to do it, but I do feel important that I do share the story because I do know it actually does help people. And because of that, I will continue to share the story because, you know, when I read sometimes, you know, about, you know, young people taking their lives. Now, a lot of them, it won't be about their sexuality. It'll be about other pressures in their life, other mental health issues in their life. And I just, you know, I wish I could have a conversation with these people so that they could see that you can come over whatever obstacle it is and life will be better. You know, it may be a case you'll have to learn to live with a mental health side, but you'll be able to live an enjoyable life by being able to deal with it. So, and that's why I think, you know, my message to people is hugely, hugely important that we all share our experiences because it will help people. And I'm sure, you know, by Ruby sharing his experiences of his life as one of the top jockeys, that will help people in their goal in becoming a top jockey. And the same with me, by sharing my experiences of refereeing, it'll hopefully help the next generation of referees becoming top referees. But I also think it's important we share the difficult stories as well, because that will help people as well, I think. And it's all raising awareness about things. So it is, it's very draining. When I talk about my personal journey and talk about things like this, it does mentally and physically, it drains me. But you know, I do know that it helps, and for that reason, I will continue to share the story until my last breath.
As a parent listening to you, I hope you keep talking and sharing your story, because if it helps to save any person, it's a story worth sharing. That's my belief as a parent. But I also think there was a stronger part in you that you probably don't realise. And to stand on the pitch against Harlequins and after a crooked line-out throw to say, I'm straighter than that one, you were able to put humour to everything you did and see the brighter side. And that's a gift in itself.
Now, I think humour is such an important part of everyday life, not only for the enjoyment of life, but also I think in dealing with adversities in life. Sometimes you don't want to make humour to belittle people, but sometimes a little bit of humour and a joke can help people. I remember when I wouldn't go out to the house for about 4 or 5 weeks after I'd come out of hospital. I was ashamed of what I did. I really was ashamed. My mum and dad were scared of me going out. Would I do it again? And my friends came up and said, look, you've got to come down. My local rugby club, Ponabeira, and they're playing a game here. You've got to come down and watch a game. So we're going to have a pint or two. And a couple of my mates were playing at the time as well. So I went down to watch the game and I said, right, I want to go home now. I'm not going to the club. They said, no, you've got to come to the club now. We're not taking you home until you come to the club and have a pint. So I went to the club, people coming up, great to hear you, you're okay and good to see you. And, you know, people were brilliant, you know, but I was ashamed of what I did. And I went to the club and one of my mates, getting a few beers in, went to get the round in. And they said to, Kendall, Ferret, Georgie, Wayne Bach, what do you want? Oh, Pintle Lager, please. Oh, I'll have a pint of Bow. Nigel, what do you want? And one of my mates goes, oh, get him a bottle of pills. And everybody laughed. And I laughed. And you know what? I stayed out all night and had a few pints and enjoyed myself because now we had the ability to have a laugh about it. That helped me so much. Now, obviously, you know, there's a time and place, you know, and you know your friends, you know the context of what this thing is going to say. And that's why I think humor is an important part. And in that game in Harlequins, it was just natural. It was the worst throw-in, bless him, I've ever seen. He was embarrassed, Dave Ward was. The throw-in went to the scrum half. Everybody was going, you could see people wanted to laugh, but you could see people also going, oh, shit, you better not laugh because that's a bad one. And I just said, he just looked at me and he could see his face was red. And I just said, you know, I'm straighter than that. Everybody was laughing at what I said. He laughed and we moved on. So, and you know, never ever have I thought about, right, one day I'm going to say on the field, if somebody chucks in the crooked throw, I'm straighter than that. I've never thought I'm going to say that. It's just come naturally. It's who I am. And yeah, your humor, never make humor to belittle people. But humor is such an important, you know, part of our lives.
I think when you start and you're the butt of your own joke, it always helps with humor. But you brought that to a pitch. What was your favorite exchange on the pitch with a player in that sense? I know the difference in rugby and soccer. I always admired the respect that you had to have for a referee in rugby, but you had some great exchanges on a pitch as well. Was there anything that stood out for you?
I suppose that the one that stands out to me probably most is you have the this is not soccer moment down in Munster, obviously. And then there's been a couple of other exchanges, but I think the one that stands out to me, which encompasses what all the game is about, I think, was out in... they tend to all happen in Ireland, actually.
Was
Leinster against the Scarlets, where I'd given a penalty against Leinster, and the Scarlets, I said, Rhys Priestson at the time was, you know, the ball was away by the touchline. So he's waiting for the ball to be given to him to take the penalty. And I'm sort of explaining something, had my back to the touchline, and the ball boy kicks the ball onto the field and catches me smack on the back of my head. And then all the crowd goes, you know, cheers. And I turn around and I call see with this ball boy standing there, you know, he'd gone white. He was, oh my God, what have I done? And I just took the yellow card out of my pocket, showed him the yellow card, all the crowd cheered and clapped. The ball boy smiled and jogged on. And then I went over and shook his hand, you know, and everybody sort of, you know. And then what amazed me was everybody was, and I think it was a Leinster back row player, I think it's only just come back from injury now for quite a long period out.
Dan Levy.
Dan Levy. And Dan Levy said to me, Nigel, Sin Bin's that way. Like, you know, send him that way. And everybody had a laugh. And that to me says everything about the game. You know, in a pressure situation like that, we can all just sometimes not take things too seriously sometimes and have a laugh and a smile at that at the right moment. But what really hit back to me was this, Ruby, to be honest, was after that, the messages I had of people, social media had, you know, gone viral with it, and people said, oh, this is brilliant. This is, you know, Nigel Owen's doing this. This is brilliant. This is funny. And I thought to myself, what do people really think that this is so brilliant? I just did what would naturally come to me. You know, this to me was just natural. You know, I've been brought up in a humorous family. Humor in Wales, like Ireland, is a huge part of everyday life. I was amazed why people found it so amazing. People were, oh my God, that's amazing. And I thought, well, it's just natural, you know? And that's maybe because I think sometimes we do take things a little bit too seriously sometimes. And again, I go back to political correctness is hugely important in society today because of equality. It helps drive equality. It helps us stop belittling people. It helps the fight against homophobia, against racism. It's hugely, hugely important. But also as well, it's important that political correctness does not go to the extreme where people are afraid to have a joke and a laugh or say something in case somebody looks for a reason to be offended, because then that then will undermine the great work that political correctness does. It's a very, very important balance to get. So never, ever lose a sense of humor. Have the ability to laugh at yourself and laugh with people. Or laugh at people. Laugh with people.
How come Paul O'Connell was only the second best player he ever refereed?
Who was the first?
I don't know. I just saw Paul O'Connell as two.
I think O'Driscoll was the first, probably. Either O'Driscoll or Shane Williams was another one. But I probably O'Driscoll, because Shane Williams wouldn't have been classed as, I refereed him for Wales, because I would have never refereed him as Wales. But he was, for me, one of the best, particularly for his stature, you know, his such a small guy, and what he did for the game was absolutely, and that did so much for rugby, I believe, making it a game for all shapes and sizes, which, of course, it's important that rugby maintains that. But Paul O'Connell was one of the greats, definitely. And if he was a second, then he's only behind Brian O'Driscoll, who was at a different level, you know.
And who was the lippiest then? Was Rog up there for that?
Sure, definitely, definitely. Rog and Stringer. Oh, when you referee the two of them together. Oh, but they were lippy in a respectful way, you know. I always got on well with the both of them, and I have a huge amount of respect for the both of them, but oh, they made my days hard on occasions. Oh, I remember then going to referee Munster against Northampton in the quarterfinal of the European Cup in Thomond Park. It's 28,000 packed in there. Paul O'Connell was injured. O'Gara was Rogers captain of Munster that day. And it was the famous game where there were 44 phases. And O'Gara dropped the goal at the end to win the game. And after the game, he came into the changing rooms, said, Nigel, thanks for the game, sat down there and had a chat. And I was over in Munster about a month before, refereeing Munster in the Guinness Pro 14 or Guinness Pro 12, whatever it was back then. And in the airport in Shannon on the way back, just before Christmas, I'd bought his autobiography for my dad as a Christmas present. So I gave it to my dad, a Christmas present, and my dad said, oh, would it be nice if you get this signed? I said, well, you know, I'll take it. And I'd never go asking players to sign things, but I had it in my bag. If I had a chance, I'd ask him. He came to the change rooms. I said, thanks for the game. Sat down at the chance. I said, what's he here? Do you mind signing this for my dad? I bought him for play. Yeah, no, of course, he says. So he sat down, signed, chatted away, signed the book. Off he went. Went back, gave my dad the book. I hadn't looked in the book. Gave my dad the book. My dad opened the book and he said, oh, he said, that's, have you seen what he's written in here? And I thought, oh, Christ, what's he written in there now? And he'd written in there, to Geraint, my dad's name. He said, to Geraint, hope you enjoy reading the book and you can be very, very proud of what your son has achieved on and off the pitch, Ronan O'Gara. And I thought, well, fair play to him. Of all the times he's been in my ear, of all the hard times he's given me on the pitch, he was forgiven there and then. So, but him and Stringer together, they, oh, They were, you had your work cut out.
I have a bone to pick with you as well, by the way. I remember in 2013, I was brought my son, Patrick, who was 8 at the time, and his mate to the Aviva, to the Lansdowne Road, to watch Ireland against New Zealand. And I got a photograph on the Monday morning from my son's friend's father with a picture of his copy from school, his copybook, where he'd written down his news from the weekend. And his news from the weekend was, I went to the match with my friend Patrick and his dad. Ireland were winning, and then New Zealand won, and Patrick's dad said the F word. So that's the that's basically what happened. So can you talk us through that? I mean, that was just heartbreak to watch. Did you feel like, I don't know if you probably don't remember the match as well as I do, but do you remember, like, did you feel Ireland falling apart? Or, I mean, I know that the last play was amazing, but like just the generally just the New Zealand coming back into it. So,
I didn't know. I didn't see that. To be fair, I'm not sure it was a case of Ireland falling apart, but you knew that New Zealand were going to come back at some point. You knew. Because Ireland started that game like New Zealand usually starts game. And this is how England beat New Zealand in the World Cup. England went out and played like New Zealand in that first half. And then New Zealand, the back foot. And that's how a lot of teams beat. They put New Zealand the back foot under pressure, which they're not that used to being in that situation. And then it's easier to hold on to that lead than it is to try and catch up with them when you're playing New Zealand. And Ireland just went out and they blew them apart first half. Coming off that field halftime, the atmosphere in the Aviva that day was absolutely unbelievable at halftime. I've never heard such a roar at halftime. But I could feel the pressure in that game. There's massive pressure because you had O'Connell and Brian O'Driscoll playing New Zealand for the last time, unless they were going to meet in the World Cup. And O'Connell would have played him again, but O'Driscoll would have finished before the World. He was finishing. So it was they'd never beaten. The two greatest of Irish players had never beaten New Zealand. And apart from New Zealand itself, pretty much every country and every rugby supporter in those countries, well, pretty much every rugby supporter in every country in the world wanted Ireland to win that day. You know, the emotion around that. But as a referee, you've got to take away from that emotion. You can't go into that game emotionally attached and thinking, oh, it would be nice Ireland to win this. These two great players have never beaten. You can't. You've got to go in there on referee. So you take yourself away from all that. And you just got to referee the game. And obviously then when New Zealand came back second half, and then they got a penalty towards the end of the game, and probably only New Zealand could do this. They kept the ball for phase after phase, one side of the touchline, one from the other, back and forth, and they scored. And then the conversion to come, then it was a draw game, conversion to come then to win the game. And it happened earlier in the game where Tommy Bowe, I think, had charged early. In the game, and I and Luke Fitzgerald, and I sort of told them after they charged early, if you charge early and they miss the penalty, miss the conversion, you'll have to take it again. So they conversion at the end of the game, win the game. Luke Fitzgerald charges early again, and I thought, if he misses this now, and I mean, it wasn't just a little bit early; it was clearly early. If he misses this, he's gonna have to take it again. So he missed it. So I said, I had to do. The popular thing that day would have just ignore it.
Oh, it was the popular thing. You're right.
Yeah, the popular thing was just ignore it. But you can't do that. You know, the popular decisions are very, very seldom the right decisions. It's the difficult and unpopular decisions which are the right ones on most occasions. And to me as a referee, the important thing for me was that I did the right decision. So I said, I have to take it again. And he takes it again, and of course he kicks it smack through the middle of the post, and they win 24-22. And Ireland were just deflated. But I didn't come off that pitch with the crowd booing. They were just all sort of this. Couldn't believe what. And of course, there were one or two would have booed, but you know, you didn't have the stadium booing you because they had just witnessed an absolutely brilliant, remarkable game of rugby. And funnily enough, a lot of people. It feels more people talk about that game than they actually talk about the game they beat them, funnily enough. for whatever reason.
It's always the way.
Yeah, I know. But so, yeah, you know, there was massive pressure in that game. And I think, to be fair, I think there was a couple of, I think Sexton missed a penalty in that game, which, you know, on every other day he would have put over. And New Zealand then just crept back to the game and got control of the game. And you knew that there was no way Ireland were going to be able to keep that ball and play like that for 80 minutes. New Zealand's chance would come. Of course, when New Zealand's chance come, you know, they take their chances, and that's what happened in that game. But it was an absolute remarkable. But that'll be up there with one of my top three or four games of rugby of all time.
It was incredible. I was at Bolt. I much preferred the second game, to tell you the truth. Nigel, obviously, when we get you onto the show, you have to take our quiz at the very, very end. Paddy has drummed up for you. He spent hours creating these questions. He's quite creative with them, really, so he is. But his jumps are the flat. Usually, Paddy introduces this part. So, Paddy, take it away.
Yeah, so we usually give the guest a choice, Nigel, really, really clever play on words here with Ruby's racing background. We give you an opportunity to take the jumps question or the flat question. The flat questions are easier. I'll just tell you, all the guests so far have chosen the challenge of the jumps questions, but it's completely up to you. If you want to be the first one to take the easy option, that's up to you, Nigel, but you'll be the only person to ever be on the show who's done that. But
very clever psychology, Pad. You just made me take the jump questions now. Well done.
Good call. Ruby, do you want to ask them or do you want to?
I go first. So right. Who's your tip for the Six Nations title?
France, I think.
Very unpatriotic.
France, yeah. Well, yeah, France. Obviously, my heart would say Wales, but yeah, Wales play well, but we haven't been playing well. But if we can play well, then win with a shout. I'd go for France. They're building up well, I think, France at the moment. It could be between France and England, and I'd just go for France.
Okay. Question number two, and this will go against your lovely nature, but which Ireland player did you not enjoy refereeing? So time to put the boot in.
Alan Quinlan.
Well, I can't say Alan Quinlan because every time I go to referee in Munster, his mum always comes up and gives me a hug and has a chat with me. Always.
Well, his mum was a lady, doesn't mean he's gentle.
Quinny always used to tell me, if I go home and tell my mum, bloody Nigel Owens today, that decision, she'll always defend you. She'll always defend you. So, yeah, I'll go for Quinny. Quinny was the one because he was always in the middle of everything.
And the greatest international team you have ever reffed?
Oh, that'd be New Zealand. Yeah, New Zealand.
Was there a particular one? Would it be the Richie McCaw one?
It'd be that era from around sort of after 20... New Zealand weren't that good in 2011. You know, they won that World Cup. They were lucky to win the World Cup against France in that final. And they were a team under pressure. And then after winning that World Cup, it seemed like the pressure now of had not won it since 1987 had gone. And then the next, until 2016, I think, during that period of four or five years, yeah, I think that is one of the best teams of all time. And particularly that game I refereed, South Africa against New Zealand in Ellis Park in 2013, which many people say is the greatest game of rugby they've ever seen. You know, they were a different level in that period. And then when a lot of those big name stars finished, you know, after 2015 World Cup, then going into the World Cup, the 20 Lions, I think, at the Lions, they just gone past their best, I think, New Zealand are, you know, when they played the Lions, and they had quite been the team they were in that period. So yeah, that to me, that would be the era from around 2012 till about 2016, early 2017. They were a different level.
Thanks a million for your time. Get back to your farming. I hope your wellies are good and high, because if the land in Wales is anything like land in Ireland right now, it's rather soggy.
It's very soggy. It's awful here.
Thanks, Nigel. You're very good. Thanks. I really appreciate it.
Hey, pleasure, boys. Thanks, pleasure. All the best, both.
Mind yourself.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, that is all we've got time for on today's show. My thanks to Paddy and Ruby, but thank you so much to Nigel Owens, who has spoken incredibly bravely about the challenges he has faced through his life. And hopefully he's given people plenty of hope as well. If anybody
feels affected by some of the topics that Nigel has spoken about, and the Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123 in both the UK and Ireland, or in Ireland, Pieta House. Their helpline number is 1800 247 247. We'll put more contact details in the show description, but thanks again to Nigel for speaking so openly, and of course thanks to you for listening. We'll be back on Wednesday, but between now and then, I've been Tom Nugent, and that was From the Horse's Mouth.